Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. Thanks to Humboldt Distillery for sponsoring the Eco News Report. Humboldt Distillery supports all of our organizations, and they make fantastic local spirits available at your neighborhood store. Check them out. And joining me from EPIC is Matt Simmons, Legal Fellow. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom.
And we also have Scott Greeson, former executive director of EPIC, now bigwig over at Friends of the Eel River. Hey, Scott.
I don't even have hair, much less a wig. Hi, Tom.
And we have Larry Glass, executive director of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Howdy, everybody.
All right. So today we're talking about our favorite subject, which is Klamath Dam removal. And joining us from the Yurok tribe is Michael Belchick, who is a fisheries specialist. What's your official title there at the tribe, Mike?
Good morning. My official title is a senior water policy analyst. My training is as a fisheries biologist, and I work in the area where policy, law, and science all interconnect.
When did you start?
I started working for the tribe in 1995, and I've been working on Klamath River dam removal since that process started right around 2000, 2001.
Yeah, so Mike is part of the crack team at the Yurok tribe who is working to get these dams out. And so we're thrilled to have him here. So he's going to give us an update on where we are. There have been some headlines in the news recently about the Klamath Dam removal. So it was important for us to get somebody who is smarter than us to come tell us about how the process is going. So thank you, Mike, for joining. So first, I saw that there are some restoration plans completed for after the dams get out, including really those fancy, almost architectural-like drawings, right, of what the river is going to look like when there are no more dams. Tell us, where are we at with restoration after dam removal?
Well, we see restoration as an integral part of dam removal. It's really important to understand that at the heart of this project, it's a fisheries restoration project. It will happen to be the largest fisheries restoration project ever undertaken, but that's what it is. Rivers have a lot of ability to heal themselves and will eventually recover on their own. What we're looking to do is speed up that timeline, create good fish habitat. So to that end, we've partnered up with RES, Restoration Environmental Solutions. This is a large company out of Houston, Texas, that specializes in mitigation and long-term restoration. They are the main contractor to the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, which is the company that's going to be taking the dam out. And in turn, we have signed a partnering agreement with Restoration Environmental Solutions. And the Yurok tribe looks forward to implementing, designing, and then doing a lot of the work to help the river restore itself.
So as a chunk of the dam removal process, how big is the restoration component comparatively? You know, if we're thinking of dollars and cents, how much is going to go into ensuring that we have a good, well-designed river after the dams are out?
You know, I don't have the exact percentages, but it's significant. It's 25, 30%.
You're just spitballing.
It's a significant part. You know, the main part, though, is to get the dams out and the river into a free-flowing status, and then the restoration projects will go afterwards. One of the main focuses of the restoration project is to see how the new river channel establishes itself. And we want to make sure that tributaries, there's going to be some new tributaries for salmon to access, that they remain connected, that they're not blocked by sediment or some sort of head cut or something that we didn't know about at first. So there's going to be evaluations and work done to ensure that there's connectivity into these newly accessible tributaries like Janney Creek, Ball Creek, and Spencer Creek up in Oregon. There's going to be lots of new areas for fish to spawn in.
Larry, it's striking to me that the company is coming from Houston to do this restoration work. On one front, it's like, wow, the capital of fossil fuels has developed real expertise in restoration, apparently. This is probably good. On the other hand, don't we have great restoration people in California? How did that decision get made? I assume they were the low bidder, but.
Well, no, it wasn't just low bidding. It was a very complex bidding process that had to do with ability to get the job done as much as just price. Restoration Environmental Solutions got their start in Houston, Texas, because they implemented mitigation wetlands for oil and gas industry there. In addition to just putting the projects in, they are experienced in being long-term stewards of these projects. So it's not enough just to put in a wetland and leave it alone. Someone's got to go take care of it, make sure it's functioning properly, everything. And that morphed the company into a business model where they assume long-term liability. So in addition to being the restoration lead, they are also the long-term liability transfer corporation. So dam removal happens 10 years down the road. There's a lawsuit. Someone needs to represent the dam removal entity. This company has agreed to stay on and take on that liability. So they're serving a dual role here, and they're quite important. And their size, ability, and expertise are really important in their selection as a contractor.
It also underscores to me that there is such a thing emerging as a restoration economy, and that there are real benefits and real work being done that involve the whole country here in Klamath Dam removal. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, from the beginning when dam removal started to take shape, the Yurok tribe knew that it wanted to play an important role in that. And it's just worth saying that we contacted Res, we competed for that role in there. There's no special favors given. We competed because the Yurok tribe has built from the ground up a state-of-the-art restoration program. So we have tribal members that can move heavy yellow equipment, that know how to operate that equipment in a river environment and have their heart into the job. And that's why we won the job as a prime contractor under Res.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Expertise plus locals.
I think that we can anticipate that dam removal is going to be a thing that will be pursued more vigorously in the coming decades all across the United States, but in particular in Pacific Northwest in our salmonid bearing streams. And this is now another niche economy that the Yurok tribe can compete in and have a new form of economic development. So it's really neat to be in on the ground floor of this project. I hope that we can take advantage of it and help to contribute to diversify our economy further. So something else I saw in the news is that the tribe or the KRRC, the Klamath River Restoration Corporation, has put out another fire, so to speak, in that it has gotten approval from CAL FIRE for its water storage. So there was an issue raised by the Siskiyou County Department of Natural Resources that they were concerned after dam removal that there wouldn't be sufficient water reservoirs to pull from in the event of wildfire. And we just had a sign-off by CAL FIRE. Can you talk a little bit more about what this means for the project, how dam removal could more broadly impact wildfire response in that area of the state?
So what CAL FIRE determined was, so let me put this way, whether or not anybody raised any concerns, KRRC was committed to doing a fire detection and suppression program and figuring out how that area was going to operate vis-a-vis fire prevention and firefighting, no matter what. The concern was raised that with the loss of the reservoirs, that the ability to dip water by helicopters and tankers and things like that might be compromised. So KRRC did complete a plan. They hired a top-notch contractor. I can't remember the name of them, but they do fire analysis and suppression all over the country. And so they came up with a plan. It involves things like remote cameras. There's dry hydrants where a pump can be attached to it quickly and provide thousands of gallons of water that's connected to the river. And it is also possible to dip water from helicopters directly out of the river. That's a common occurrence downriver, for example, Orleans, Happy Camp area. It's common.
I've seen it myself, yeah.
Right. So then the CAL FIRE then takes the plan and evaluates it for adequacy. And they made a determination that the plan was adequate. Us normal human beings have sort of a value judgment, like adequate. That sounds like barely good enough. What it means is that it passes strict, rigorous analysis and standards and will suffice as a plan moving forward. I would also point out that several of the large fires that have happened in the recent past, in particular Paradise, for example, were caused directly by small power generation facilities located in higher fire danger areas. So with the removal of all the power lines and infrastructure here, we also see the risk going down, at least from that source.
That's right. This raises a really important set of questions, Mike, for our effort to get the two dams out on the Upper Eel. As you're well aware, we've had two of the largest fires in California history happen in 3 years right around the footprint of the Lake Pillsbury Reservoir. And one of the arguments we're now hearing pretty often from folks who don't want Scott Dam removed is that's absolutely necessary to fight fires. it's pretty amusing in a dark way, because having the reservoir there didn't prevent those fires. it didn't really help. And like you say, there's plenty of ways to get water out of the river. So this is a subject we're going to have to confront. And I'm really glad to see you guys dealing with it and showing that it can be done.
Yeah, it can be simultaneously the source of ignition and the way to fight it. And that's just not a good way to move forward.
Yeah.
To perhaps be more pessimistic about all of this, it seems as if we have a number of issues that are being raised by critics of dam removal that are not being raised in good faith. And I suspect that fire might be one of them. We see already in the comment section of any article about climate dam removal, lots of folks who you wouldn't necessarily expect to care about clean energy suddenly touting the benefits of carbon-free hydroelectric energy and oh, what about the poor fish, because you know dam removal is only going to heat up water. So all these folks who never gave a damn about fish before the dams were proposed to be removed are now fighting using our own language back against us, which is interesting. And let's tackle some of these myths. Let's address some of these bad faith arguments. And the listening base here on the Eco News Report, we are the folks who are championing dam removal. So you are going to be preaching to the choir a bit, but I think that we all see these arguments being made, and it is effective for us to counter them when we see them. So I want you, Mike, to help provide us the ammunition to counter these bad faith arguments when we see them. So let's talk about how much clean energy will be lost as a result of this dam removal. It's not much, right?
No, it's not very much. The nameplate capacity on all the dams put together, it's about 170 megawatts, but it never operates to capacity. It would take full flow through all the turbines, which rarely, if ever, happens. In fact, the dam generates about somewhere around 70 to 80 megawatts, depending on the water year type, how much water is going down the river. Early on in the dam removal negotiations, replacement power was a really big deal and was a topic of frequent conversations. We explored wind energy, local wind energy, things like that. In the end, the company said, you know what, we're bringing on a lot of renewable energy. It's not even a term in the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement. Basically, the company said, we got this, don't worry about it. They have thousands of megawatts of renewable energy coming on throughout the western states. So PacifiCorp, which owns the Klamath dams, was located throughout Wyoming, parts of Colorado, Utah, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and California. And in particular, a lot of those sort of intermountain states have a lot of wind energy coming online right now. And that's what they're banking on for the future. Simply put, solar and wind is just cheaper per kilowatt hour than maintaining these sources here. And there's even a lot of question about the carbon neutrality of these hydroelectric facilities. In a lot of areas in the world, these reservoirs produce a lot of methane due to anaerobic decomposition, and methane is 20 times as strong as carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And so the carbon neutrality of these sources has come under serious question right now.
Welcome to the Eco News Report. Mike Belchick of the Yurok Tribe is here talking to us about their ongoing efforts towards removal of four dams on the Klamath River.
So I think in general, I won't ascribe like bad faith or something to these, what you might call disinformation. A lot of people have been told that certain things are true about the dams that are not in fact true. And the people that are promulgating this misinformation, they are responsible, but they have caused a lot of people to believe them in good faith. And it's kind of a microcosm of what we see on a national scale in our politics right now. So if you want, I'll run through sort of like the top five.
But just before you do that, Mike, I want to just step back a sec and for context, contrast the figures you provided for the Klamath project and its electric output to what we're dealing with on the Upper Eel. You said, you know, you've got a nameplate of 100 plus megawatts, actually produces about 70 to 80 megawatts, but even that doesn't really matter to PacifiCorp. we're dealing with a project that has a nameplate of 9 megawatts. And, you know,
there are single wind turbines that produce more energy than
more
that.
Power.
Yeah,
seriously.
Seriously,
Scott Ham and the hydro output. But get this, PG&E, our utility, you know, the one we're dealing with, has told us that it costs them between $20 and $30 to maintain the facility for every dollar they get in selling that power. As you said, Mike, it's just not economical. Hydro isn't competitive with solar and wind.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I know that dam removal is deeply unpopular up in the area where the dams are, but this is a private company that owns a private asset that's money losing and wants to get rid of it. So you cut to the core of it. That's what's going on here.
It seems that this has just become another piece of evidence in the perceived rural war on rural living that us coasties and us liberal city elites, we can't appreciate what it's like to be a Siskiyou County rancher or whatever. Boo.
This is Humboldt. We're all rural. Come on. Yeah.
All right, Mike, I want you to give me some more. What are your top myths that you want to bust? And actually, I came up with this idea. I want to talk about this because I saw you do it on Facebook and you did it in such a lovely way that, you know, if I'm doing anything on Facebook, it's smarmy and I'm an ass about it. And and I point out how the other person's stupid, right? Like I do it in all those ways that you should never do it because no one will ever listen to you. But you did it in this nice, wonderful way. So I will give you the one that I saw you respond to, which is, what about summer flows and temperature? You know, we have all this water behind the dams. Isn't it good for salmon in the summer that we can release that water and have better summer flows as a result of this dam? And doesn't releasing water cool the river? So isn't it bad for salmon if we take out the dams?
Right. So this is one of the most pervasive pieces of misinformation that is circulating around right now. You see it a lot on social media. But even among elected officials there, that the perception is that the river will have very low flows and very warm flows without the dams. And that simply, just to be really blunt about it, that is false. That's not the way the system works here. The dams don't influence the water amount except in very short-term increments. They simply don't have the storage that other large storage facilities like Shasta or Trinity Dam do. They don't have the ability to influence water flows except on a very short-term basis. They also don't cool the water down to an appreciable degree during the summer. And in fact, once the summer passes and the salmon start migrating up to their spawning grounds, I'm talking September and October, the dams are hanging on to that summer heat. They're storing a lot of that summertime heat, and they're releasing water that is far above ambient water temperature. Without the dams there, the river would cool from the top down, you know.
But why does that matter to fish, Mike?
Well, by the time you get to September, there'd be frost already going in and the water would be much cooler. But why that matters to fish? Well, salmon like cold water. That's what I learned in my fisheries classes at Humboldt State University. So if the water is too warm, if it's very warm, it will actually block their migration. If it's on the upper edge of their migration, the eggs can suffer mortality inside the female salmon even before they're laid. And so you get reduced viability.
Pre-cooked.
It also exacerbates disease that we've had on the Klamath. The fish disease that caused the fish kill, ick, is exacerbated by warm temperatures. The gill rot columnaris is exacerbated by warm temperatures. You know, salmon evolved in cold water systems. And so these dams are causing water temperatures in the fall to be elevated by almost 10 degrees Fahrenheit over what they would be without the dams. The dams do have a small amount of cold water available to release, but only a couple weeks worth, and it's anoxic. It's not good water quality. So that's, you know, as far as temperature, that's definitely a big myth right there.
I was wondering if the tribe has other activities that they're looking at to monitor temperature, because I know even after dam removal, it's probably going to still be a concern, you know, just with climate change and sort of the background problems we all have. And so I was wondering if the tribe is working on other stuff to manage temperature.
Well, as far as monitoring temperature, yeah. I mean, you know, the cost of a temperature monitor has fallen down below $50. I mean, you can just buy one, throw it in there and download it. So everybody's got temperature sensors everywhere. Several of them are telemetered. I can get on the internet and look at the temperature at Iron Gate, like right now, like what was the temperature 15 minutes ago. as far as temperature activities that may affect temperature, on a river main stem like that, really you're at the mercy of like climate, solar radiation, and things like that. The river is too big to shade with riparian vegetation. So really what we have is the main stem temperature is ruled by climate factors and topography, and the tributaries and smaller tributaries, they're very much affected by riparian shade, like which is affected by fire or forest management practices and things like that. And the way the system has always worked is that the main stem will reach pretty warm temperatures, but there's all these cold tributaries that come in that provide refuge from those temperatures. And so protecting the tributaries is probably our main activity with regard to temperature.
Great. Thank you.
All right, Mike, I've also seen people express a concern about flooding, that all of a sudden we're going to lose our ability to control the river, and an uncontrolled river sounds scary, and that visions of 1964 float through people's heads. Is flooding going to be a problem after dam removal?
Well, it's interesting that you said visions of 1964, because Iron Gate Dam came very close to failing in the 1964 flood, actually, and the spillway was heavily damaged. And if the flood had been any greater in magnitude, it would have taken the entire dam out. And you can see the photos, the post-flood photos from 1964, if anybody wants to verify this. So with regard to normal operations and flood control, these dams are not operated for flood control. They're hydroelectric generation dams that have very little storage. So they're generally operated pretty close to full pool all the time. Whereas in a normal flood control dam, like, say, Shasta or something like that, you can empty out the dam and then wait for a big storm and then capture that whole flood and while it fills the reservoir. These reservoirs are already full, so they don't ameliorate the floods at all. The best they can do is perhaps delay a flood peak by a couple of hours, but they don't lessen the flood peak or anything like that. And the other thing, as I just alluded to, is that the dams themselves are a flood risk, in particular Iron Gate. So Iron Gate Dam only has an outlet for the electric generation, the penstock. And then after that, the water has to rise and spill over the spillway. And there is no emergency spillway, none. So what happened on Oroville, like if that spillway fails during flood operations, it's right on the face of the dam. It's not removed from the dam like it was in Oroville. If that spillway fails, the whole dam could go out. And it has happened already before. And so... When we look at the flood control, you need to look at the whole thing, that the dam itself is a flood control risk. And just finally, I'll just give you an example. After the 1997 flood, so much water was passing over the spillway that FERC Safety of Dams reevaluated the flood risk and required PacifiCorps to add 7 more feet to the top of Iron Gate Dam and to enlarge the spillway intake, because after the 1997 flood, they determined that the current configuration of the dam wasn't safe in a probable maximum flood. So, you know, ourselves living downriver from that dam, when I look at things like that, there's no plan B, there's no emergency spillway, there's no other way to evacuate water out of that dam. We look at it as a flood liability.
Mike, there's another claim that keeps getting raised that strikes me as mostly being offered in bad faith, but wrapped around a kernel of reality. And that's the claims by folks who want to keep dams that we won't succeed in bringing fish back by taking the dams down. They say the problems for salmon are somewhere else, downstream, out in the ocean. How do you deal with those responses?
You know, I think working for the Yurok tribe, our mission is simple. We're restoring this river. That's an imperative that's handed down from culture, from the Yurok tribe constitution, and that's what we're doing. So when we look at how to restore this river, we need to think about resiliency both in the short and the long term, and there's a lot of things to be done. The thing that I like about the Yurok tribe is they've never been afraid to think big. We were talking about dam removal with a few other close allies long before anybody else jumped on board. So when we look at what needs to happen to fix this river, we've got to think landscape scale, and that's what dam removal is part of. But that's not all that needs to be done. We have other issues. There's issues in the streams that are going to receive salmon, the Upper Klamath Lake. The Sprague and Williamson Rivers right now are in bad shape. They need to be restored. The Shasta and the Scott Rivers have big-time issues right now, and those need to happen. in the Trinity. There are some issues with flows on the Trinity. So what we get as a common refrain when I've worked on these issues, whether is that, why are you picking on us? It's not just us. You need to look elsewhere. We're picking on everybody. And we're equal opportunity picker honors here. And we will take on whatever issues need to be taken on to rebuild this river. And so we look at dam removal as a foundational element of fish restoration, but it's not going to get the job done by itself. But without dam removal, you're just going to have a lot harder of a time continuing on with viable salmon in the Klamath River than you would. So that's how we look at it. It's a foundational element, but the job's not done.
So I wanted to make sure that we touched on two more topics, though. First, has the 2020 elections changed the prognosis for dam removal? Have they increased timeline or increased your certainty that these dams will be taken out?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I think when we look at like what happened to make dam removal closer to reality ever than it is right now, a lot of things had to happen right. We went through a very deliberate strategy, and I got to give a tip of the hat to tribal members and to people who did direct action. They really did move the needle on this, and it really did help a lot. The current agreement that we have right now does not involve the federal government except for the FERC regulatory oversight. We don't need any congressional funding. We don't have to have administration approval or things like that. This is the company taking an action. The only reason there's regulatory authority is because it's on a public waterway, and thus it falls under FERC. There are some other permits to get, like Army Corps of Engineers, stream bed alteration permit, and things like that. So the fact that the last administration was not really for dam removal, we still believed it was moving forward. Now we have an incoming administration that is far more friendly towards these efforts, and it will help if they write a letter to FERC saying, hey, this administration's for it, and things like that. But it's not absolutely necessary. Where we're at right now is in the labyrinth of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission process by which we receive approvals to transfer the license from the company to the states and receive permission to surrender the application and take the dams out and those kind of things. The FERC commissioners are presidential appointees, and so this one will revert to a Democrat chairmanship on the FERC commissioners themselves, and it will also have a Democrat majority. But the FERC staff and the commissioners have been fully briefed on this. They're not allowed to say whether they're in favor of it or not, but we haven't heard serious objections at this point. So what I think is that this was happening, and now with a new administration, it's even more likely, it's even more certain to happen, is how I feel about it.
Excellent. All right. I always liked how The Daily Show ended with a moment of Zen. And so I will do something similar, which is a moment of hopefulness. I don't know what it is. So something else, it's not Klamath Dam removal related, but it is dam removal related, which is news that an Idaho Republican congressman, Mike Simpson, has come out in favor and has a proposal for removing dams on the Lower Snake River in Idaho, which connects to the mighty Columbia River. Mike, any closing thoughts on what this portends for the future of dam removal more broadly?
Well, I as a fisheries scientist and a restorationist, one of the things you see with restoration projects is by far the most successful projects are those that remove migration barriers and open up habitats that have been previously blocked. Whether it's a culvert on a road in Fieldbrook or whether it's the Klamath Dams or the Columbia River Dams, the salmon in the rivers have shown an ability to restore themselves quickly and efficiently. And so I would expect nothing less from the Snake River. And we're gaining experience in all sizes and shapes of dam removal and being able to evaluate whether dam removal is right in certain situations. And I look forward to seeing more of it.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining the Eco News Report. Looking forward to having you on again in the future to tell us how dam removal is going.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, really thanks.
Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot, you guys.
All right,
see ya. Go fight with the reclamation over 2021 water year, and we'll have a know about that one soon.
So this has been another episode of the Eco News Report. Join us on this time and channel next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.